It's the Mystery Atheist edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, gender selection, the first Mona Lisa, you and Vito over Syria, gender generosity, and sinful honor killing. Let's begin episode 152.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sort, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns.
We have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is Ethan, your freethinking historian.
And this is Dawn, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist.
Wow, Dawn's added new titles. I'm going to stick with mine and be Jenna, your biochemist.
Hi, Jenna. Ethan, you know, this is a week that I think we have wins and fails. I'm going to start off by mentioning a small bit of what I think is a fail. Is
good. Always go with the negatives first. Good, good.
Yeah, well, you want to end on a positive note. I read that in a book about positive thinking. Yeah, there we go.
Bullshit.
So apparently Vancouver is going to be honored with the very first Chopra Yoga Center, sponsored by Deepak Chopra, one of his things. And it's supposed to be opening up here in Vancouver relatively soon. Of course, it's one of the not quite so horrible versions of Deepak Chopra. He's not teaching cosmic awareness or anything. I did a bit of research. It seems to be largely based on just the idea of yoga, Pilates, and that sort of thing. But it does push this whole seven spiritual laws of yoga, which is one of those things that just drives me nuts. It's like, well, these are important laws that will make your life better. First law is try and do good things. It's like, no, I was going to do crappy things my whole life. And it's, but anyhow, Vancouver has the dubious honor of being the first place in the world, apparently, to have one of these centers opened up, and it's planned to be an international chain. So, fail.
Like McDonald's international chain?
Yes, I guess. McDonald's will only kill you. Deepak Chopra will take your mind from you.
Now, I haven't done a lot of yoga, so I'm not a major authority on the subject. But isn't there sort of spiritual teachings that go along with a lot of yoga that are not sort of specific to our friend Mr. Chopra?
Yes, but remember, Deepak Chopra's sort of idea is he takes sort of traditional views and he mixes them with sort of some New Age lubricant. And he sort of gives it to his patients as sort of, you know, this will sound kind of familiar and you'll want to spend your money on it, but it really has very little relationship. Like, I mean, Deepak himself is, if you had to point him down, the Hindu. But he does his affairs in such a way as to never offend Christians and to make it sound vaguely Christian-esque so that when he's in the United States and his operations are in the United States, he can bank on that sort of pseudo-Christian belief system.
All right, then.
So, obviously, we have a fail for Vancouver, but I understand, Ethan, that you had something that might be considered a bit of a win.
Well, that's right, Don. I did, actually. It was kind of an interesting situation. I blogged about this on Saturday on our blog, of course, RadioFreeThinker.com. I was waiting for a bus in Vancouver, and I saw this shiny black car pull up and park a few feet from the bus stop.
Wait. Stop right there.
Okay.
Did you check yourself? Did you see if they were getting out to get you? Shiny black cars coming up and pulling right up beside you, if the movies have taught me anything, are a bad thing.
Well, you know, I didn't, actually.
Was it overly shiny?
It was pretty shiny. It was quite shiny. I mean,
the red flag.
Yeah. Well, it turned out okay in this one instance, but I guess you could advise listeners, if you do see a shiny black car pull up, run away. Run very fast. In this case, it was all right for me, though. What caught my attention, actually, was not just that it was a shiny black car, but I distinctly saw a Jesus fish on the side of the car only instead of the typical, you know, Jesus saves message, it had one of those skeptical humanist messages, much like my own evolve fish or the flying spaghetti monster or one of those sharks eating a Jesus fish saying evolution. And I noticed the car had a website called StopReligiousViolence.com and a slogan, "My spiritual leader licks my face." Now, that could mean many things. What I took it to mean is that this was some kind of very creative atheist and perhaps belonging to some kind of skeptical humanist organization here in Vancouver. I had never heard of this organization before. Unfortunately, just as this car pulled up and the driver stepped out of the vehicle, my bus arrived and I didn't have time to run over and talk to him. So I took a quick picture of the car and hopped on the bus. I later looked up StopReligiousViolence.com, but the link wasn't working, and we'll perhaps reveal why in a little bit. I also tried to track down who or what group this refers to, but couldn't find any answers. I did find a few discussion threads on the internet, Reddit and a few others, that had pictures of the car around Vancouver. So it's been seen, and people are aware of this, that it's out there. But I, you know, reasonably connected to the skeptical scene in Vancouver, I never met this individual before, nor had I seen this car before. So I was kind of concerned and a little intrigued. Who is this mystery atheist?
Well, you know, Ethan, you need worry no more. I have discovered who our mystery atheist is.
Really?
His name is? Okay. Well, we shouldn't really mention his name until we've at least contacted him and make sure that it's okay. But he is a local. He lives in Vancouver. It looks like the website itself is like a work in progress. I looked up, and the domain name itself was registered like within a month or two from today. So it's usually the way these things sort of work is people who have this idea or some project in mind will go and they will buy their domain name to sort of ensure that they have it. And then when they're actually ready to launch their project, they'll actually make a website, and boom, it'll appear on the internet. So. We do have his email address, and I think we may try and get in contact with him and find out what is the mystery behind this particular atheist.
And where did he get that cool car?
Oh, yeah.
And why is it so shiny?
And, of course, we won't even mention why it might be black.
And what spiritual leader this is that licks his face?
Oh, I suspect it shares the same sort of taxonomy as Jenna's spiritual guru that she has mentioned many times on the show. Who seems to have a propensity for pancakes, among other things. But
puppies make excellent spiritual leaders. I'll just leave it at that.
But some things in the world are not quite as good, or maybe they are. Recently, an editorial in a major Canadian medical journal urged doctors to conceal the gender of fetuses from all pregnant women until 30 weeks to prevent sex-selective abortions by Asian immigrants. Now, I find it a little weird that they would mention the word Asian, although there is a cultural proclivity for that. But apparently, according to the article that I was reading, female infanticide happens in India and China by the millions. But it also happens in North America in large numbers enough to distort the male-to-female ratio in some ethnic groups. According to the editorial by the editor-in-chief, Raj Kaul, and this was the Canadian Medical Association journal that this appeared in. And in the article, it mentioned some interesting things that, again, strike me as a bit odd. It cites a U.S. census data from 2000 that shows male biased sex ratio among U.S.-born children of Asian parents. And there's also cited a study of 65 Indian women in the United States from 2004 to 2009 that showed an 89% of them terminated pregnancies with female fetuses.
Hmm.
Now, as far as studies go, this was 165 women over a period of 5 years. And again, 89% might have meant that one of them had an abortion and the other ones didn't and said it was for female reasons. I mean, the numbers just struck me as very low that, you know, of all the people they could have had over a five-year period, they only picked 85 Indian women, and you could have even done a survey to get this kind of data. Canada, in 2004, outlawed fertility practices that would increase the likelihood that an embryo would be a certain sex or that would identify in vitro the sex for any reason. So essentially, we outlawed in this country pre-fertilization sort of sex selection. Which led me to think of some weird questions. But just to finish up what the article had said, Kale, the guy I quoted before, said that the Canadian medical establishment needs to go further than this sort of pre-selection selection and make express rulings that would ban fetal sex disclosure for 7 months, after which, of course, it would be too late for an abortion to be legally done in Canada or ethically done. Alexandra Condra, head of the Pro-Choice Women's Federation of Quebec, agreed that abortive sex selection is unacceptable, but questions the motives of those who support formal measures to prevent it. Any type of restriction, she says, on abortion are met with skepticism by pro-choice community generally. A more appropriate intervention with sex selection is to do more education, especially if we are talking about sun preference, rather than seeking some limitation on women's choice or access to information. Now, again, there's been a number of stories posted in the science blogosphere about how abortion is being abused by women who wish to ensure male children. To prevent this, the doctors are being advised to not mention the gender until the 33rd week, at least as a non-legally binding thing, just sort of a part of your ethics. But again, my big question here is, if abortion is okay, then why is gender selection sort of wrong? I mean, don't get me wrong, it smells wrong. But if you sit there and you say that, you know, a fetus is not a person, then to gender select isn't like you're discriminating against women, because if it's not a person, it's not a woman either. But I'm waiting for one of you guys to set me straight, because I get these weird ideas.
Well, I agree with you that it seems like a situation that really chooses you to pick an uncomfortable side of a debate, no matter what side you pick, because, like you said, you know, if you're deciding that abortion is, you know, a woman's choice and or a couple's choice, as the case may be, and sort of a right that should be available as part of a general woman's health priority, then you're basically saying, yeah, that abortion is okay. And then if abortion is okay, then gender selection should be okay if the only consequence is actually skewing the gender ratio, which in a developed country like Canada isn't really going to make an enormous difference in everything, especially as the earning potentials and sort of job opportunities for men and women are very similar, or should be very similar, or should be approaching more and more similar every year. I mean, it's not exactly like we're worried about population decline at this point in the world. So, but as you say, you know, picking that side of the debate, saying, oh yeah, it should be okay because abortion is okay, it suddenly forces you to say, wait, it's okay to ensure there are fewer women in the world? And I think one of the things that might smell so sour about it is that by saying that, you are sort of supporting or at least enabling a culture or a group of cultures or even individuals to sort of perpetuate this belief that men are more valuable as children than women. And so you're sort of buying into the reasons that they would be doing it by saying that it's okay to do.
I can see that. There is one thing, too, that like whether a law is needed for this or not. In Canada, there is one sort of barrier to getting an abortion. Is it needs to be medically approved by a doctor. Abortion in Canada is seen as a medical procedure and not so much an ethical issue one way or the other. But you are right. I guess that there is that sort of secondary stigma that gets attached that, oh, you have a daughter, sorry to hear that sort of thing, which this gender selection would sort of make more prevalent in the culture.
Well, and not only prevalent, but saying, yeah, it's okay to think that way. It's okay to act on that. It's okay to put men above women in your family. That's okay. And we're going to give you the tools and the resources to be able to do that.
So maybe one way to look at this is kind of like affirmative action in a bizarre sort of way that, you know, although in the one sense, it's wrong to deny a certain degree of autonomy with deciding the sex of your child, but because we live in a society where that can be used to discriminate, we will sort of reverse discriminate and say, no, you can't have this particular choice.
I think it puts us in a position where we have to judge the motives of people, and that's always a risky thing, especially when it comes to something like abortion, which is considered such an important and fundamentally individual choice. And for there to be some kind of group decision about that kind of steps in the face of the whole notion that it's supposed to be about a woman choosing whether or not to have a child. And if we're going to say, well, hold on, we need to, you know, vet your decision, then it's not really her choice anymore, is it?
Well, and I think as well, I mean, you can definitely see why there's so much backlash to the idea of preventing women from having this information. Aside from just a freedom of information type thing, I think everyone can understand why, right at the surface, you know, this gender selection seems like a bad thing to encourage in our society. I think people including people that are fighting this type of legislation, I think they can understand on a guttural level that that sort of feels wrong or smells wrong, as Don was saying. However, abortion has been such a hard-fought right to win that you can see why any restrictions, as this Alexia Conradi woman was saying, you know, any restrictions that are being put on that choice that has been so hard to achieve in the first place can feel like a step backward for women's rights.
I think also there's this idea of legislating morality. I think, again, the spokesperson for the pro-choice side, I think, pointed to the right way to do is through education, and that sort of legislating a moral stance, just it's like the thin edge, right? I mean, it seems, again, it smells wrong to say it's okay, but it seems almost as bad to say, well, we will legislate morality.
On the other hand, saying just education with no immediate action seems like a bit of a naive point of view to me.
Yeah, but you're a woman, so.
If only my parents had known.
So maybe we'll just agree that this is sort of a bit of a quagmire, and hopefully some of our audience members will have an opinion about this, and they can contact us at info@radiofreethinker.com. Let us know what you think about the idea of gender selection, whether legislation towards abortion should be used in order to prevent this sort of practice. But speaking of gender, one of the most famous women in history is the Mona Lisa, and I understand that she's lifted up her skirt and revealed some secrets. Ethan?
You're taking this story in an odd direction there, Don. But actually, have the secrets of the Mona Lisa finally been revealed? And this is what art historians and curators at the Madrid's Prado Art Museum are asking. And of course, us skeptics want to know, was Dan Brown right? Is there some Da Vinci Code to be broken? Well, unfortunately, the truth isn't quite as dramatic as Dan Brown's best-selling work of fiction would have us believe. While lacking cinematic dramatics, this discovery is nonetheless rather exciting for art lovers and fans of Leonardo da Vinci. So, conservators at the Prado in Madrid recently made an astonishing discovery. Hidden beneath a black overpaint was what was assumed to be a replica of the Mona Lisa, made after Leonardo's death. But it actually was painted by one of his key pupils, who was actually working alongside Da Vinci. The picture is more than just a studio copy. It changed as Leonardo developed his original composition, meaning the two paintings were made at the same time, probably side by side. Now, the final traces of overpaint are now being removed, I understand, very carefully, by the way, and it's revealing some amazing details. Yeah. So they've uncovered some really striking background images of the Tuscan landscape. The backgrounds, which match Leonardo's masterpiece, the varnish is also being painstakingly stripped away, especially from the face of Mona Lisa, which is giving a much more vivid impression of her eyes and smile. Now, if you compare this to the real painting in the Louvre, which will not be clean in the foreseeable future, this replica offers a very rare, clear look at her. The original is covered in dust and varnish, and it makes, you know, Lisa look like she's middle-aged, and it's not very attractive looking. But this copy reveals, well, a very young, very beautiful young woman, and it's quite amazing. Now, obviously, both the Prado and the Louvre have authenticated and agreed that this is an authentic copy of the Mona Lisa. They both agree that it was made at the same time as the original, and obviously, you know, it's a famous work of art that is going to be forgeries out there. Now, the original idea was that this copy was made by a Northern European artist, but they did some detective work on it, and they discovered that the painting is not what it was originally assumed to be on oak, which was, you know, rarely used in Italy at the time, The painting is actually found to be walnut, which was used in Italy during this the red time frame. They used infrared reflectography images to take images of the Prado replica, and these were compared to the similar images from the original Mona Lisa, and this allowed the art historians to peer beneath the paint and see the original underdrawing and the changes that would have evolved during the composition. Now, the underdrawing of the Madrid replica is very similar to that of the Mona Lisa before it was finished, which again suggests that the original and the copy began around the same time and were painted next to each other. Now, what is most exciting about this is that it reveals a lot of Leonardo's original painting. In the Madrid copy, there are areas that are better preserved than the Louvre painting. The replica gives us more details on, for example, the spindles of the chair, the frill on the edge of the fabric of Lisa's chest, the semi-transparent veil around her left shoulder, arm, and elbow. And this is all great news for art lovers out there interested in art history and Leonardo da Vinci especially.
And it shows that she was the wife of Jesus?
Well, see, this is the sad part for the conspiracy theorists out there. There is no details or hidden codes anywhere in this painting. For example, it does not show that Da Vinci was the leader of a secret cult. There's no secret codes, and there's nothing to indicate that he was some kind of Knight Templar or time traveler or anything like that. So what we end up with is a pretty amazing find for art historians, and it kind of just shows you that sometimes a great work of art is just a great work of art.
Now, you know, there is one thing about this, though, because you mentioned, you know, there was no secret codes in there. But to be fair, one of the complaints we often have about conspiracy people is they say, see this big obvious thing? That's supposed to be secret. Whereas if it's a secret code, it should be next to impossible to find. So there could be a secret code in there. It's just we don't know what it is.
I don't know. I'm totally calling my secret code bookie because I had bet like crazy that there was nothing there. I'm rolling in the dough now.
We're back. The UN Security Council proposal to invoke its charter responsibility to protect was vetoed by China and Russia last week. Now, many people have questioned why we, the West, intervened into Libya to protect those civilians, yet we stand by and watch a government slaughter its own people in Syria. Well, you can blame Libya, or at least how we did the job there. One of the concerns by international governments, like Russia and China, was that the UN mission wasn't really to protect the people, but was an opportunity to get rid of an internationally unpopular dictator, i.e. regime change. As it turned out, they seemed to be right. The role of NATO, the instrument the UN chose to protect the people, seemed not to limit or prevent Gaddafi's ability to punish his people, but to actually act as an unofficial air force for the liberation rebels. Now, it could be argued that getting rid of Gaddafi was a good thing. However, the poor choice of mechanism for regime change seems to have come home to roost, and the people of Syria are paying the price. Assad, Syria's ruler, unlike Gaddafi, has some strong supporters in the international community. Iran, Russia, and China being the most notable and important. Even though I think, and grant me a moment of sentimentality here, that political leaderships in these countries desperately do want to stop the deaths in Syria, they do not want to get rid of Assad. He is far too important to their geopolitical machinations. They fear, and history has seemed to have proven them out in Libya, that the UN intervention will not be limited to protecting civilians, but will be used as a means of regime change. Sadly, they're probably right. Of course, others may argue that if NATO actually did the work in Libya, and we, the West, control NATO, why don't we have NATO unilaterally intervene? First, it could risk a war with Russia and China. Also, without UN cover, it will not be seen as humanitarian by the Arab world, notably countries like Iran, Turkey, and Egypt, all of whom who can make operations in Syria difficult at best, and at worst, may support Assad militarily to defend the rightful government of Syria. Because this operation would lack legitimacy of a UN Security Council resolution, they would be right, for it would legally be an act of war of NATO by intervening militarily. Secondly, Syria has a military. One of the facts that led to the defeat of Gaddafi was its relatively small, aged, and ineffective military. Libya has been on an arms embargo list for decades. Syria has a large force, well organized, and with modern and deadly weapons. Libya's forces were largely used to suppress its own people. Syria, on the other hand, is constantly preparing for war with Israel, or at least defense of war by Israel, something that sees as a major threat and, at least conventionally, is able to deal with. The only hope the people of Syria have is perhaps the Arab League of Nations, sort of the local UN. The Arab League has sent in observers to judge the level of violence, but they quickly left because, sadly, for them, the level of violence was too high for even them to measure or acknowledge. The Arab League is composed of 21 nations, like Egypt and Saudi Arabia. However, these nations have had difficulty presenting a unified front in the past, and there are a few of them that are actually have militaries that could take on Syria. Of course, another major issue is that after the Arab Spring, most of the oppressive nations, like Saudi Arabia and Egypt, do not want to promote liberation movement. The Saudis sent in troops into Bahrain to stop an uprising there, and the Egyptian military is trying to maintain its control over Egypt after the loss of Mubarak. It is so sad that something that was such a good idea was abused and used, and sadly the people of Syria are suffering the consequences and paying for it with their life.
The key here is to recognize the rather difficult aspect of international relations in terms of conflict resolution.
If we take our skeptical tools, and if they had been used by sort of the politicians of the day, they would have realized that one of the possible outcomes of them abusing this mechanism is it would actually be self-defeating in the long run. Again, one of the reasons why the skeptical process is important just as much for politicians as it is for super scientists like Jenna. Okay, we're back. Speaking of learning new lessons and such, apparently there's some new study in how men are trying to impress women.
Well, is that really new? I mean, honestly, are we surprised by this?
No.
Okay.
Well, I haven't seen any men trying to impress me lately, so maybe I've been hanging around the wrong men.
It's entirely possible. This shocking new study that has revealed something previously unknown, it appears that men will try to impress women they find attractive. Now, these groundbreaking results were published on the 2nd in the British Psychological Society's British Journal of Psychology. The research showed that men will increase unselfish acts when they are being observed by women The research showed that men will increase their unselfish acts when they are being observed by women. In addition, the study also found the number of kind and selfish acts by men will correspond to the perceived attractiveness of the ladies watching them. The study was undertaken by Dr. Wendy Iredale of the Sheffield Hallam University and Mark van Voet of the University of Amsterdam and the University of Oxford. They performed two experiments. In the first, 65 men and 55 women, all of an average age of 21, anonymously played a cooperation game where they could donate money via a computer program. The donations were selfless acts, as all other players would benefit from the fund, while the donor wouldn't necessarily receive anything in return. Players did not know who they were playing with, They were observed by either someone of the same sex or opposite sex. And when players knew who were observing them, men were found to do significantly more good deeds when they were observed by the opposite sex. Now, when women were observed by members of the opposite sex, they did not change their donation habits. For the second experiment, groups of men were formed. Males were asked to make a number of public donations. Those donations increased when they were observed by an attractive female. They would also start to actively compete with each other, trying to make larger donations to appear more unselfish than the other men in their group. Now, when they were observed by other men, of course, the donations didn't increase like this.
I'm wondering here that when they did this study, were they making allowances for, I don't know, the availability of, like, if you were already in a pair of bond, would that alter the way this sort of worked? Or is the idea of this is like, you don't really have any control over this, and you're going to do it because, well, it's genetic.
I don't know. I didn't notice anything like that in the write-up. But what the researchers were speculating was that it's sort of like the equivalent of a peacock's tail. Now, the interesting question is, of course, is how can we sort of narrow down on this to determine what is really going on here? Obviously, this was done with heterosexual men. So we'd be curious to see what would happen with homosexual men. Would we also see the same sort of reaction? And the behavior was not noticed in women, where they would donate more depending on who's watching them. So I wonder what other factors might create this sort of a similar result. What if we varied the age of those who were involved, whether they were married or single, or some other factors that might input, you know, change the results here?
If I were to take a stab at what's going on, I probably wouldn't think that it has too much to do on the current relationship status, just because that type of behavior doesn't tend to. So, for example, for a very trivial example, people that are flirty tend to stay sort of flirty, depending on, you know, regardless of whether or not they're in a committed relationship. And a lot of these types of psychological rewards that people are getting that are ego-related are just that, they're ego-related, which is very much to do with the individual rather than their life situation. And so such a reward like this might have consequences for finding a partner, which may be, if it did in fact evolve, due to a selective advantage, that would have something to do with it. But that type of behavior isn't necessarily going to be specific to the sort of coupling status of the person at the time. It might just have to do with the ego of the individual that then has implications for the relationship status down the road.
There's actually two things I'm taking away from this that could be interesting. One is it kind of goes against the sort of stereotype that women are more generous and that sort of thing. Because you think, again, when given the opportunity, that they would, that's sort of their evolutionary trait, is that, hey, I will be a good caregiver for our children sort of thing, to be very sort of blatant about it. And then, of course, it also works for the men, I guess, because, again, if we do this sort of very primitive evolutionary psychology sort of thing and all the dangers that entails, that one of the reasons why a female picks a male is because he will be a good provider. And the idea that if he's willing to give more, then she will be able to take more, so to speak, in the fact that, you know, I mean, if you're raising children, you need to have more resources. And that would seem to be perhaps a good precursor or teller that he will be a good provider.
It's possible. But I mean, at that point, though, then the male is demonstrating his willingness to sort of will not be selfish, which would actually, I think, hinder any sort of pair bonding that he would have with a potential mate. The other possibility here, of course, is that in any sort of competitive arena where multiple men are in, they are not necessarily saying, I want to donate more to impress the ladies. It's simply, I want to win this status game to impress the ladies. So perhaps it wouldn't matter if it was a game about donating more to charity. It could be something as simple as working out or playing
sports. Taking more shots.
Or it could be something like, painting the best copy of the Mona Lisa. What it could come down to is simple sort of competitiveness for mating privileges.
Well, I thought the part of the study, I mean, you didn't know what other people were doing, wasn't it? And that you were giving it to people who you didn't know who they were. The only real big variable here was the idea that you didn't know who the observer was, or you did know who was sort of watching you do this particular activity, was it not?
Well, they didn't know. The point was that they wouldn't donate as much if, they were being observed by another male or a potential sort of non-mate. But as soon as they found out that they were being observed by a potential mate, they altered their behavior to be more generous. But again, I think that actually sort of supports the idea that they're just trying to win this sort of minor status competition to appear the winner. Regardless of what it is they're winning, they just want to be the winner.
I'm going to disagree, I think, with what I'm reading here. Because when males were observing, and you think, again, if you're competing with other males, you would want to show, see, I am more generous. But when the other males were observing, they didn't increase their donation. And according to the notes I have, they didn't decrease it either. It was only when women were the observers that you had the change in behavior.
Well, exactly, because now there's a prize to be won. But they have nothing to gain when there's just other men around, because they're not looking at other men in terms of a potential, mating partner. They're looking only at the women as potential mating partners. So they're only going to improve their status or one up each other when the women are watching.
Yeah, I don't know if I agree with the competitiveness aspect, which I think is the spin you're putting on it. Because again, to be competitive, there needs to be someone else. Whereas to say, hey, I am a good provider, to be selfless doesn't mean the contrary is to be selfish, right? So again, I'm not sure if this is to be the same thing as in playing a sport. Hey, I'm trying to win this game. Obviously, yes, you're trying to win over a mate, and in that sense, by being generous, will help me sort of win that game. But I don't know if it's quite in the same sort of competitive versus the I am more suitable sort of idea.
Yeah, I disagree with Ethan for completely different reasons than Don. Just that I really don't buy your premise that men are more competitive when women are around than without women. I mean, I, being a woman, haven't spent very much time around men without other women there, because it's sort of a contradiction in terms. But men seem to be kind of competitive whether or not they care that you're there. And that whole, competing to be the best thing. And as far as, various psychological papers and that kind of thing, tends to come out whether or not women are there. So I don't see that changing that much just in the presence of a woman.
Well, again, I'm not suggesting that women or that men are only competitive around women. That's clearly not true. But I do think that one of the problems with, say, a study like this, especially trying to read too much into it the way evolutionary psychology might have us do, is that it's pretty easy for one male to make this into a competition by just being having a certain personality. So he makes a significantly large donation, so some other man tries to match it, and all of a sudden you have essentially a bidding war. So I personally think, it's an interesting study, and it's kind of funny in a little few ways, but I personally think it's not all that surprising, given that it's very small, and again, evolutionary psychology they're trying to make a lot of assumptions here based on very little data that I don't know. I don't think it's all that convincing for regardless of what theory they're trying to prove at this stage.
Well, that gives us some very interesting things to talk about and to discuss as we have our cocktails, coffees, or whatever we're going to be doing after you listen to our show. And if you'd like to share your insights and your comments about what we've discussed, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com. Go to our website, www.radiofreethinker.com, and let us know your particular opinion on this.
Oh.
Okay, we're back. Now, we were talking about relations between the sexes, and apparently Canadian imams have issued a fatwa against honor killing. Seems a bit late, but better late than never. I find it funny that in a religious context, it was not obvious that killing or maiming women for the sake of honor was wrong, morally wrong. Okay, maybe not exclusively to religion, but it seems at least one of the last bastions where this thinking is still common and allowed. Often, honor killings involve things like burning women alive or having acid thrown in their face, or even simply just shot to death because they were somehow immodest, or that this was really some sort of, they were immodest. They did something that caused a loss of honor to the family. And I mean, it gets so twisted that in some cases, these women are being killed or punished because they were raped, and that somehow their being raped was a dishonor. It can get really, really twisted. Anyhow, in response to the recent convictions in the Shafia trial for the murders of four female members, over 30 imams signed a fatwa condemning honor killing, domestic violence, and misogyny as un-Islamic. It also attempted to explain how previous mistranslations or interpretations of Quranic verse were incorrect, implying male superiority or the need to, quote, strike an offending wife. The superiority is explained as a man has a superior duty to provide for his family and not that he's somehow superior. So again, you know, God sort of wrote these words and he wanted it to be tough for us to understand. So women got beat for hundreds and hundreds of years because someone thought superior meant one thing when it meant another. And oddly enough, when they use the kind of uses the word strike, should actually be sight. Now, I'm not sure whether Arabic and English is close enough to make that as a linguistic thing, but this misreading had a man who knew his wife was having an affair. He was first supposed to advise her. Then he would abandon her bed. And lastly, it would normally say strike her until she obeyed. But the new correction says that a man would first educate her, take a separate bed, and lastly, cite her to the authorities. So, you know, he would just sort of tell on her, but let the imams or whatever deal with what needs to be done. They do make it clear that that they added honor killing as a major sin in Islam, and those who commit the crime should be punished both by secular law as well as justice of Allah in the next world. The fatwa itself, and there should be a link on our website for this, is 3 pages long, 4 if you include the signature part, and mostly tries to explain that Islam is not a religion of violence, which is a meme we hear often, and it never was. It also is all about love and genuine obedience to Allah, standard PR stuff. I thought it's kind of funny that they use the concept of obedience to prove that Islam is a nonviolent religion, at least with regards to domestic relationships. Because they state, quote, obedience to Allah is not accepting Allah unless the person does so free of his heart. And I don't know, somehow obedience itself strikes me as a form of violence and domination, but I guess in this context it seems okay. Thoughts?
Well, I got a few thoughts about this. So I'm gonna put on my angry atheist hat for this one. The first part, the sort of notion about violence, domestic violence being un-Islamic, I find like reprehensibly insulting. The notion that they're going to explain away centuries of misogyny by saying it was someone misread a quote is ludicrous. The idea that they can say things like, oh, well, you know, people being burnt alive, having acid thrown in their face, or being shot to death, that was because you misread sight and strike. Okay, that's garbage. Like, the notion that they think somebody is going to look at this and go, oh, right, of course, they got a few vowels mixed up. That explains all the abuse that they've been heaping on people. And, of course, this is not just limited to Islam. I mean, you can look at any organized religion that will make this claim that, oh, well, you know, those people there who are violent, they're just misinterpreting the Bible or the Quran or whatever ancient religious text that they're trying to support. Who are they to decide the definitive version of Islam? You know, if, for example, the Westboro Baptist Church thinks that it's perfectly okay to do what they do, who is someone else to come along and say, well, their version of Christianity is wrong, and our version of Christianity is right? To me, it just seems quite silly. And they're arguing over scripture and writing that was written hundreds of years ago and trying to sort of drag it kicking and screaming into our current century and whitewashing all of the horrible misogyny and violence that was written into the original text. And it's just so insulting to me. I wish they would just say something like, yes, it was written by a bunch of misogynistic jerks, and we, you know, these critical thinking, rational human beings who want to believe in a sky daddy now, here and now, are just going to sort of say, well, you know, you mispronounced one of the words and you didn't translate it correctly.
Yes,
so.
Ethan, I know, but you really know they're not going to do that. Jenna, do you have a different take on this?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's a really sort of narrow-minded atheist-centric point of view. I mean, religion is not only, I mean, some people will call it a beast of, you know, like the spirit or the soul or the mind, but the fact is that it's also cultural too, and people don't just abandon that kind of thing. So I see this not so much as people trying to defend their religion from outside so much as be able to reform a religion into something that they're comfortable actually being associated with. I mean, a lot of people who prescribe to the religious, the Muslim faith, are probably, well, definitely outraged at the type of things that are done under the banner of Islam. And I think that this is a response to that, as opposed to saying, you know, yes, we're Islamic, but we don't believe in certain things, or yes, we're Islamic, but not those type of Islams, or whatever, to actually take responsibility for their own religious beliefs, and then to help people to resolve that conflict in themselves as well, help other people by providing an alternate explanation and something that's different. And yeah, I mean, you can criticize people for saying, you know, quibbling over words or whatever, but the fact is that those quibbles have very real consequences in the real world. And if people are, you know, going to change their understanding of strike to sight, which a lot of people may do because they felt uncomfortable with the strike in the first place, giving that alternate explanation, even if it is linguistic-based, can help change a lot of behavior and make people a lot more comfortable with their place in their society, which may be very much bound up in their religious beliefs or just their religious culture.
So maybe what you're trying to sort of say is that instead of taking sort of a hardline view, and I must confess I'm probably more on Ethan's side than your side, but see this more as the evolution from a religion to a philosophy, and it evolves over time, and even though the woo behind it is still horrible, it's a step in the right direction.
It's a step in an absolutely positive direction, and starting to take responsibility for the things you're told versus the things you choose to believe is a major step in deciding to step outside of whatever construct you actually don't feel comfortable with. And so I think this type of re-examination of things that really have been in place for a really long time is not that common. I mean, it's going against tradition, and that's always a really hard thing to do. And so I think it's actually quite a courageous step.
I don't see this at all as taking responsibility. I think this is really shifting the blame from people who are tangentially supporting fundamentalism and trying to draw this arbitrary line in the sand. You know, I liken it to the Catholic Church. Instead of actually trying to do something to stop, you know, its decades of abuse and of children and people all over the world, they come out with some kind of statement saying, you know, we don't support abuse. Well, Wonderful. Nobody supports abuse. That's one thing to say. It's another thing to actually make changes to your organization to stop the abuse.
But
and that's the difference.
I don't think that that parallel is actually that valid, because in this case, some of the things that actually were written or understood by some people to be written, supported by the religious doctrine, i.e. that strike, you know, that actually was written there in the minds of many people. And so they actually are trying to change how people look at that inside the organization. And I think one of the things that can be really divisive in this point is when you bring up blame, it's sort of, or your previous points about sort of what's happened over the centuries past. But I think that this type of move is not so much trying to misplace blame for past deeds and defend the religion so much as look to the future and how things can be ameliorated, at least for the near future and the far future. Again, everything continues to evolve, and obviously keeping with a very dogmatic religious point of view is not an excellent thing for the world, but everything happens in baby steps, and I think this is a great one.
I think one of the things that that complicates us slightly is the idea is that, you know, this particular one case where the one family, one guy, killed his wife and three daughters, would he have done that anyhow just because he's an ass and an evil person, or does this religious view enable it? And if the religious view kind of enables him to do it, then, I mean, this fatwa may be a step in the right direction. I don't know, Ethan?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question. Does a religion that, you know, whether or not it clearly or tangentially, vaguely supports violence, I mean, we can talk about what Steven Pinker talked about in The Better Angels of Our Nature, how, of course, that the cultural view of violence is going to shape actual violence. And whether or not somebody goes out there and commits an act of violence is going to be shaped by how they are going to be responded to by the people around them. And again, like, you know, I'm going to, you know, return to sort of what, you know, what Sam Harris would have said, is that it doesn't matter if some moderate Muslims or some moderate Christians go out there and, you know, declare to the world their moderation. The moderates, until they become as radical as the atheists in condemning violence and this sort of fundamentalism, will continue to cast the shade that the fundamentalists will recline in and continue to preach their, you know, violent rhetoric. And I don't know. I just don't find this all that satisfying in that respect. I think that, you know, of course, murder and violence is wrong. We shouldn't need an extra asterisk next to that to say, oh yes, and it's also wrong in religious context. It's always wrong, regardless of the context.
I think just to put in my last thought here, something else that sort of might be causing a divide in our sort of opinions on this topic is I see it as sort of a way to reach people that might not be reached by a different type of message. So I understand, Ethan, that you feel really strongly about the atheist message and that that is the right way to go, and I'm not disagreeing with you in the long term. However, I think that it's misguided to think that that same message has the possibility of reaching the people that need to hear it. And so I think moving toward that message through, yes, more moderate steps, and specifically more moderate communicative steps, is going to make a bigger change in the long run.
Yeah, I think actually, to sort of wrap up this, again, I tend to agree more with Ethan on my own thing. I think religion is more of a force for evil. But there's always that sort of debate, is do we be hardline and sort of the asshole atheist? And I think we need to sort of, as Ethan's saying, is like, honor killing is wrong. Well, duh, you should have known that long beforehand. But Jenna has the thing that if all your warriors in the battle against religion are hardliners, you're going to lose some of the battles. And I think what Jenna's kind of saying is that, you know, sometimes a softer approach, like this baby step that they're making, and maybe it is just a baby step, will help move them towards the rational side of being an atheist. And I guess this is something that we probably can't end here today, but I'm sure our listeners will have an opinion one way or the other, and I encourage them to send us their comments and such via info@radiofreethinker.com. So I guess we're about to end today's show. Do you guys have any skeptic highlights?
So my skeptical highlight this week is to keep your ears to the ground and keep your eyes peeled, especially for, you know, shiny black sedans. But specifically, in the next weeks and months, there might be something in the pot of cooking for your friends here at Radio Free Thinker, mashing up with those, you know, mavens of comedy. Yes, that's right, mavens, over at Caustic Soda. And there might be a live show combining the two shows coming up. So if you have anything that you'd like us to discuss or any questions you might have, send them to our email at info@radiofreethinker.com, and we'll see what we can do about working those into the show.
What's a maven?
I think it's a woman now that I think of it. So, you know, I just threw it in there.
I thought it was what happens to old ravens as they become maven. Okay, never mind.
I think it's a skilled woman at something, but I'll have to look it up.
My skeptic highlight for this week, actually, I've got two of them. They're both lectures. One is Richard Heiberg, opening lecture. It's Theater A, Room A130 at Langara College. It happens February 10th, this Friday, at 5 to 7. It's free. Richard Heiberg is one of the world's most effective exponents on the urgent need to move away from fossil fuels and towards a post-growth economy. He's the author of 10 books, including 2010's big hit, The End of Growth. His wiry, unflinching approach addresses challenges of both climate change, peak oil, economic instability, and food insecurity. So if any of these things tweak your bells, go out to the lecture and find out what he has to say and organize yourself together. My second highlight is Gwyn Dwyer, The New Middle East. He's going to be at the MD Cinema at SFU downtown. That's 149 West Hastings Street, February 8th, which would be the Wednesday.
And my birthday.
Ooh, happy birthday, Jen. 7 to 9. Tickets are $10. Ethan, do you have any highlights?
I do have a highlight, actually. I'm going to cast I'm going to encourage our listeners to check out the AAH, which stands for the African Americans for Humanism Organization. This is an organization that supports skeptics, doubters, humanists, and atheists in the African American community. It is a program run by the Council for Secular Humanism, headquartered at the Center for Inquiry Transnational in Amherst, New York, and directed by Debbie Goddard and a member, an 8-member advisory committee. The AHA has recently enacted a brand new campaign. They will be launching national multimedia advertising showcasing religious skepticism in the African American community. It will coincide with Black History Month, and the campaign will feature prominent African-American humanists from history, along with contemporary activists and organizers. Ads will run in New York City, Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, Chicago, Atlanta, Durham, North Carolina, and Dallas. So if you're in one of those cities, keep your eyes open for those ads and support the African-American Humanist Organization.
I have an update. Maven, an expert or connoisseur, Yiddish, not a woman. That's right. They are mavens of comedy.
Okay. Thank you, Jenna, for correcting us on our definition of English. You are our now go-to person for any words that we don't know what they really mean, but insist on using them anyhow on the show.
In English and Yiddish.
That's a lot of words.
Okay. Well, I think this is the end of our show this week. Thank you all for listening. This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Jenna saying the real world is amazing.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the star.